Today's talk is given by Dr. Helen Burlingham of University College London. Her talk is entitled GIS Explorations in the Coastal Zone. Helen Burlingham is a geomorphologist specialising in historical coastal behaviour, estuary coast morphodynamics, coastal responses to late Holocene and contemporary climate forcing, and coastal GIS and geospatial analysis. Dr. Burlingham is currently involved in the NARC Environmental Agency funded coastal sediment system project iCoast in a consortium involving Southampton, Oxford and Manchester universities and a range of other research institutes. She recently led an English heritage project that integrated a range of archaeological, morphological, paleoenvironmental and multispectral satellite data to examine the prehistory of Solent estuaries. Prior to that, Dr. Burlingham held a Crown Estate Cairn Research Fellowship, during which she undertook detailed analysis of the historical evolution of the Outer Thames. She has published widely in international journals and has undertaken consultancy for English Nature, HR Wallingford / Fluor PLC, the Environment Agency, DEFRA and the Crown Estate. We therefore look forward to a wide-ranging seminar linking GIS, remote sensing and a range of topics which will be of interest to our ever-diverse and equally interesting audience. Over to Helen.
Hi everybody, afternoon. So I'm at UCL, Coastal and Estuary Research Unit, and I'm a geomorphologist really, but I do quite a bit of GIS with it, and I suppose I've done GIS ever since I was doing research, and I like to think I've progressed on slightly from just the mapping side of things into the analytical, but we shall see. I was kind of thinking about what I could talk about today, and it's always a wee bit daunting when you're coming to talk to a GIS audience about GIS when you're not actually a GIS specialist and you just happen to use it. I was at a historical GIS conference a few years ago doing a talk on some of the historical stuff that I was doing. I was absolutely petrified because I was thinking, well, all these people are just going to know tons about GIS, and like, here I am just using it willy-nilly and such, and I seem to enjoy it, so I hopefully I'll talk about some things that are of interest to some of you today. So what I thought I would do is actually look at three different projects that I've kind of been involved in, undertaken throughout the last few years, within which GIS has been kind of a central component to the work that I've done, the analyses that I've done, and kind of general progression of ideas within that particular topic. First one, looking at geomorphic persistence, this is looking at kind of estuarine channel systems, dynamics of such. This is kind of stuff that I started out doing during my PhD over in Ireland, looking at the estuaries of Northwest Ireland in Donegal, and I've kind of just started doing more GIS type stuff after my PhD. And then kind of was able to take on some kind of new ideas and kind of new methods, I suppose, to try and help me understand a bit more with those. The second one there is this English Heritage project that I recently had, kind of going slightly outside my technical area of expertise, but somehow quite enjoying it at the same time, looking at intertidal archaeology. I suppose it's coastal, so at the end of the day, it's coastal and it will work. That was with quite an interesting team of archaeologists and myself. And then the last one I'm going to talk about is aspects of seabed morphodynamics and work I was doing with the Crown Estate and the National Maritime Museum, looking again at kind of historical coastal behaviours but on a much larger scale, looking at the entire Outer Thames estuary in fact, and in that context using GIS and spatial analysis to understand a bit more about system dynamics. So they're the three kind of projects, and I'll just progress through each of them and then there'll be any questions you have about any aspects of what I've talked about, we'll just cover at the end. So the first one then, is geomorphic persistence. As I was saying, the subject of my PhD was looking at these estuaries on the northwest coast of Ireland, just looking at the general morphodynamics of these systems. They're sediment-rich estuaries that sit within quite structurally controlled valleys. So you have a lot of sediment, and sediment can, you know, readily move around. But then they're sat within these very stable rock-based valleys. So the kind of overall estuary itself can't move around at all, but the material within it and the channels, the low tide channels within these estuaries can move around quite substantially. So what I wanted to, well, certainly when I was doing my PhD, I was doing a range of kind of field-based and map-based work. But then subsequently, I was trying to think of ways in which I could analyse the channels specifically to tell me a bit more about the geomorphology and the geomorphic behaviour of the systems. And it was in particular looking at some of the satellite imagery that I started to look at some of these channels in a bit more detail. And I noticed some specific factors that seemed to be controlling the system, but I again wanted to find a way of kind of representing that just beyond kind of the shoreline analysis sort of traditional way of looking at coastal change. So I kind of happened across this kind of idea of locational probability, and it's a method that's used quite a lot in river geomorphology, where you are assessing a system or a feature on the basis of how likely it is to occur in a particular space over a particular time frame. Now, in river geomorphology, then what it's generally been used for is to show areas of instability versus areas of stability. But it's starting to be slightly broadened in terms of its role, enabling us to have a better idea of what the forcing is on a geomorphic system rather than just kind of this broader scale mapping. Now, the example I've got down on the right hand side there is just this is a satellite image of part of the Amazon River, and I've just done a quick NDVI on the image up there, and then I've just thresholded it to pull out where the water is versus where everything that isn't water is. And this gives us a very clear picture then of where the river is versus land. And then if we take that over a series of different time frames, so I've got four different satellite images there that I've used exactly the same technique to pull out exactly where the channel is. You then use a weighted representation of those different years to then present kind of this location of probability, the probability of the channel being in a particular location over a particular time frame. So in this particular image here, then anything that's black, there's been water there for 19 of the years of the full time frame considered, whereas anything that's kind of slightly greenish has been there for anything between 19 and 0 years, so somewhere that's less stable, I suppose you could consider it. So that's kind of the basic idea behind locational probability. And I then applied that to these estuary channels. So although estuaries, obviously, they're intertidal, so there's quite a transitional zone. Within these particular systems, because they're very sandy, then you have quite a strong low tide ebb channel, which can be very easily delineated from satellite images, aerial photographs, maps, and so on, and therefore can be digitised quite easily. And you get, if you did it on a basic kind of mapping perspective, this is a sort of map that, or figure that you can produce, where you just see general changes in the position of the channel over a period of time. But if you then apply the kind of locational probability analysis to this, and one of the, it works particularly well if you have well-distributed data and data that you can readily pull exactly the same information from. So you're wanting to know that you're always looking at exactly the same feature over the time frame considered. And what I did here was integrate mapping surveys, chart surveys, black and white aerial photography, colour aerial photography, and landsat imagery to derive my spatial mapping of the ebb channel, the low tide channel. And then I applied a weighting associated with the kind of time frame between each of those layers. And the assumption there is that you assume that if between one survey and the next, then nothing has changed. You know, the feature essentially persists in the same place. And there are different, slightly different ways to derive the weighting, but it's always based on this kind of the amount of time that's gone between two different surveys. And obviously, the longer the time is between two surveys, the slightly more problematic your outcome is going to be, so because you're assuming that nothing has changed between the two surveys. And that's kind of one of the downsides of this approach. But I proceeded anyway, and this is a sort of, this is the outcome of that particular analysis. This is just two of the estuaries on the Donegal coast, and what we've got here are the expression in the low tide channel, where it's black, that's where the low tide channel has always been in all of those different layers. And anything that's grey, kind of shades of grey, shows where the channel has been at some point, but hasn't persisted there over the full time frame. Very nicely for this particular site, it enables me to really recognise the persistence of that channel in these very localised areas. So in Loch Ross Moor, which is the northern estuary there, there's persistence certainly in this on the southern margin of the estuary, just south of what's known as Connell's Bank, and then between Connell's Bank and this headland here. And in Loch Ross Beg, which is the southerly estuary, again, persistence in the channel along this northern margin of the estuary over that 150-180-year time frame. And yet throughout the rest of the system, incredible kind of movement, really, in where that channel has been. So in the upper estuary regions, both estuaries show quite significant channel dynamics. So it was quite a useful way of demonstrating this spatial variability in the persistence, the geomorphic persistence of this dynamic feature in one respect, but very static feature in these kind of very specific areas within the estuarine system. Now, just to put this into context slightly, I'll just take you through a few photographs of the site, just as an excuse to show some nice pictures. I'll go back a second. In this estuary here, so the persisting channel is between this sandian system here and what is a rocky headland to the north. And throughout the entire time series that we have, we know that channel has always existed in exactly the same position. Now, ordinarily, you would assume that any of this area here could be easily eroded because it's simply sand. It is a big sand flat. Most of this is supertidal. It doesn't really get covered by the water unless we have really strong westerlies and surge events. And then a large dune system here. Now, that's all just made of sand. It's mobile. It can be moved. And as you're in this terrain system, it is moved. It's readily moved by the channel. And the channel is mobile with it. But for some reason, in this particular area, the channel is always pushed to the far north of the estuary valley. And one of the reasons, it seems, for this is the fact that this valley extends just to the south of that particular mouth in the estuary. It's a nice kind of glacial valley, and it's aligned about south-southwest, and is very good at funneling strong winds into the estuary and maintaining this sand feature as a tongue, it's a kind of a protruding tongue out into the estuary, and over the course, you know, over decades to centuries, is very capable then of actually constraining the channel position within the estuary. So even though it's mobile material, it's sediment, it can move around readily, the sheer fact that we have this other kind of geomorphic kind of feature within the landscape, within the local landscape, seems to enable that kind of persistence in the channel simply by providing the forcing for that dune system sticking out into the estuary. Now in the other system, we've got this feature called Connell's Bank, which again provides a very specific control within the estuary system reducing the movement of the channel around there. And this sits out in the estuary, what is otherwise a completely sandy estuary, as a very kind of dominant but low profile feature. This is actually made up of cobbles, all these kind of rounded cobbles. It's quite a peculiar feature, and I've never really got to the bottom of actually what it is, what it's derived from. There's some suggestion that it's associated with a barrier that would have formed perhaps 6,000 years ago during kind of marine transgression, but we still haven't really kind of understood fully what this feature is. But in terms of the kind of historical scale of morph dynamics, it has quite a significant control on the channel behaviour within the estuary itself. But just show a quick animation of the movements in the channel, the low tide channel within this particular estuary. You can see that obviously the channel kind of moves around it, but can never kind of switch to the other side of Connell's Bank. And so it constantly retains this structural control over the dynamics of the channel within the estuary. Now the other thing that I've put this figure up for is the small feature just to the top here, which in the early days, which is the light coloured channel kind of representation, it has no impact whatsoever on the system. But then as the channel migrates northward, it then starts to have a role in controlling the position of the channel and the dynamics in the actual movement of the channel as a whole. And that feature is, again, something relatively small within the context of the entire estuary. It's just a small walkout prop, which is actually acting nicely there as an anchor to a salient feature that sticks out from the estuarine shoreline. And what's particularly interesting about this is that throughout most of the kind of 19th century and certainly early 20th century, that feature didn't actually exist as a feature within the estuarine system, because it was actually covered by a dune system. So had dunes sticking out into the estuary, quite a large dune system there, and I've just boxed where the actual rock outcrop is in the context of the 1951 and the 1977 era photographs. And as you can see, it's only kind of basically the late 1980s that feature, that rock, was uncovered through the erosion of the dune system by this northerly migrating channel. So what we have there then is a rock feature that has essentially emerged as a new structural control on channel dynamics within the system. And again, it was through the kind of GIS side of things, the analysis of certainly some satellite imagery, that enabled me to kind of start pinning down these features, simply because it enabled me to look at the spatial and temporal within the same kind of context. And that's kind of led to some, you know, broader ideas on phases of geomorphic behaviour within these particular estuaries. I'm not going to go through this in any great detail, but we have spatially and temporally varied sensitivity and kind of response within the system over decade or two century timescales, and quite complex responses, certainly in the latter stages of the behaviour that we've seen recently in responding to these newly emerged features. So I guess the kind of some of the outcomes of that work were the fact that we can use this locational probability within ebb channel environments as well as river environments, being able to understand get a better understanding of the temporal and spatial variability in the behaviour of these systems, and certainly recognise the role of changing structural control within the actual estuarine system. So that just kind of some broad ideas there on how using GIS, I suppose, has enabled us to kind of look at one aspect of geomorphology within the context of these estuarine systems. Okay, so the second project that I was going to talk about is this coastal archaeology project. This was funded through English Heritage through their Heritage Environment Enabling Programme. And this is one of those projects that just kind of comes about rather bizarrely. You meet one person, get chatting, and then somehow 3 years later you're PI on a project about archaeology, and it was quite bizarre, but a very interesting project all the same. And the idea here was that Oleg Ron, he's basically an archaeologist with remote sensing kind of interests. He's done a lot of work in Scandinavia looking at Scandinavian terrestrial archaeology using hyperspectral and multispectral imagery, and in combination with Julie, who's this officer of maritime archaeology within Hampshire and White, she had worked with Ole in the past on some archaeology, and a combination of three of us together really, kind of came up with this idea of perhaps trying to use these multispectral approaches within coastal environments to see whether or not there was any worth in applying the same sort of techniques that Ole applied in Scandinavia to some of the coastal environments that we have in the UK. Now, the rationale, I suppose, behind this was that intertidal archaeology in general is quite challenging. You can generally, if you're doing field surveys, then you can only do these at low tide, so you have a very short window to actually go out and do any field mapping, which means that the length of time it actually takes you to do an entire archaeological survey of an entire intertidal area is substantially longer than it would be within a terrestrial environment, simply because you can only go out there at certain times of the day. So the whole process is very, very costly and very time consuming. So within coastal environments, the idea that you could potentially survey these sites remotely would be great. You know, it has great potential there to actually make a significant difference, perhaps more so than within terrestrial environments. One of the other things is the fact that high resolution and multispectral imagery is increasingly available. It's still not exactly cheap, but it's certainly made far more accessible than it would have been perhaps even 10 years ago. And as I was saying, what we were doing is basically following on from some work that Ole had been doing over in Scandinavia. And what he was basically showing was he was looking at various terrestrial features, and a lot of his work has shown how they were able to identify things like cooking pits from quick bird and Iconos imagery. We weren't quite so lucky in this particular project. It didn't quite work in the same way that Ole had found the work progressing within Scandinavia, but I think we learned quite a lot from the process as we went through it anyway. So the rationale, or the idea behind the analysis is the fact that although you can derive a certain amount of understanding about surface characteristics through things like aerial photography, and certainly high resolution aerial photography can give you a really good understanding of the textural variance within surfaces, the slightly longer wavelengths are much better at capturing aspects related to moisture and vegetation. And as soon as you bring in the kind of moisture and vegetation side of things, then you can start to then perhaps understand a bit more about what's going on subsurface. Because if there's a feature below the surface that's drawing water away, is perhaps particularly absorbent, then the vegetation at the surface is going to reflect that change in moisture availability. So the ideas behind this have worked well within terrestrial archaeology. And what we were hoping to see was that the same sorts of ideas might make intertidal remote sensing archaeology something that was actually worthwhile proceeding with. This is just an infrared aerial photograph of one of my sites actually in Ireland, just demonstrating the importance of this kind of the red and the near infrared this site is kind of sandy, marsh, kind of macaire environment. It's all relatively flat. There are very few kind of features geomorphologically that can kind of give you much information about how the system works. But an infrared aerial photograph shows quite a significant variability in the vegetation cover across the site. And this is the same sorts of ideas that we were trying to use within the intertidal archaeology project. It's the fact that using the red and the near-infrared bands is going to basically broaden our capabilities in examining these kind of intertidal features. That's what we hoped, anyway. So the project was based on the Portsmouth and Langston harbours on the south coast of the UK, and we chose these sites primarily because obviously Julie works with the Hampshire and Wight Trust for Maritime Archaeology, but also because these sites are littered with archaeology. They're absolutely teeming with archaeology to the point that you can walk along shorelines and find just flint fragments all around. You know, there's just finds everywhere. And we thought by having quite a substantial amount of archaeology on the ground, it would enable us to go through quite a rigorous approach to calibrate the satellite data in order to then perhaps explore the site for new anomalies and hence new sites that hadn't been found in terms of the archaeology. So these are all the archaeological features, and within that we also included all of the obstructions that are listed within the UK Hydrographic Office obstructions and wrecks. So it's a very kind of broad archaeology in the sense that we're talking about all features that exist within the intertidal zone. So absolutely littered, and so the idea behind this was that we would have plenty to see, I suppose, within the various data layers that we were looking at. So the approach was that we would evaluate the existing sites, the registered archaeological features. We would actually almost calibrate the image analysis process on the basis of these registered sites so that we could then examine the images for specific anomalies that might indicate the presence of archaeological features based on the fact that we knew where all of the registered sites were. And the data, we had quite a significant database, as I just showed, of the actual existing archaeology, plus using some of the really old maps just to corroborate some slightly more modern archaeology. We were also able to use very high resolution aerial photography, so it's 0.2 metre pixel resolution, which is really quite fascinating resolution. We also had LiDAR data, but the main thing that we were evaluating was the quick bird imagery, and the multispectral bands of that had a resolution of about 2.4 metres, and the panchromatic had a resolution of about 0.6. So quite a substantial amount of spatial data with which it kind of makes sense that we'd be able to evaluate the kind of archaeology quite clearly through that. Now, first thing that we did was to just look at the features that currently exist, that we currently know, and identify where they are visible and where they aren't visible on the various layers that we were using. So what I've done here is just kind of ordered the different types of features and just split them between which is subtidal and intertidal. Obviously quite a lot of obstructions and wrecks are subtitles, so we're kind of slightly beyond our capability anyway. Now, when we look at the number of features, I think we were looking at about 750 features in total, registered archaeological features. When you look at the ones that are actually visible, so these ones are the only ones that are visible, we're talking about 10% of the actual archaeological features that we know are present were visible through the aerial, panchromatic, and multispectral. And in actual fact, the aerial was far better at being able to find these features than So then we look at the intertidal, just a broader perspective, looking at the intertidal features, understanding whether or not they are visible or partly visible or possibly visible versus not visible at all. The aerial photography was always better than the quick bird, either bird, and actually the panchromatic of the quick bird was better than the multispectral of the quick bird. And what this gradually, you know, came down to was the fact that it was the resolution that mattered and not the kind of extra wavelength capability. It's just the subtitle features. So very large proportion of the subtitle features just simply weren't visible at all. So if you then think, so all of those dots are basically all of the features, all these 700 plus archaeological features, and all the ones that are red are not visible on the quick bird multispectral. It's only the blue ones that are visible, and there's a few black dots which are possible recognition, but not exactly convincing. So this was a rather awkward point in the project when we kind of realised that actually the data that we had couldn't even pick up 10% of the existing archaeological features. So how the hell were we actually going to make any kind of inroads into finding out anything new about these sites and finding new features? And just looking at a few of the specific types of archaeological features, so find spots, bombing decoy, this is basically a percentage of features in each category, aerial, pan, and multispectral versus yes, they are visible, no, they're not visible, or possibly visible. And unfortunately, most of them are a kind of 100% or near a high percentage along the no line, meaning they're not visible. And then when considering aerial versus pan versus multispectral, it's really only aerial that shows anything more than a very low percentage of features visible. So they're problematic, to say the least. And at that point, to some extent, I think the guys from Denmark, the people that had pioneered this idea, kind of slightly lost interest because it obviously wasn't doing what it did in their world. And you know, fair enough. I mean, it was certainly challenging. And English Heritage, I think, was slightly concerned that they put a bit of money into something that wasn't actually going to go anywhere. But we kind of ploughed on, explored everything to death, basically. This is just some examples of, these are specific hearth sites that have been identified. They're not visible in either the panchromatic or aerial, and they're not visible under any manipulation of the multispectral quick bird imagery. So the next step then was to actually say, well, okay, let's ignore the fact that we haven't actually been able to do a very good job of identifying the things that are there. Let's just see whether there are things that people don't know about. So where are the spectral anomalies? Where are the things that ordinarily we would be looking at these images and thinking, well, I wonder what that feature actually is. You know, can the method still identify things that are of interest archaeologically? And these are all the different anomalies. I think we had about 108, I think it was, in total, anomalies that were just unexplained during the process of the analysis. And bearing in mind, we had Julie Satchel, a kind of a local archaeologist who knew the sites very, very well on the ground, who would be able to kind of very quickly say, well, no, there's no point calling that an anomaly because I know what that is. So the idea was that we were looking for things that were completely unexplained based on kind of expert knowledge. So if you think about the types of features that we were finding, we had features that were completely visible on every single version of our layers, so visible on the panchromatic and the aerial, and visible throughout all of the various manipulations on the multispectral data. We had features that were definitely very prominent on the multispectral imagery, so these very distinct anomalies in the images, and then were vaguely present on the pancromatin aerial, but not particularly convincing. And then we also had features that were pretty much invisible on the aerial and pancromatic, and certainly if you hadn't got these lines provided on these two images, you wouldn't have expected, you wouldn't have seen anything present within the intertidal area here. Yet on the MS imagery, we've got very clear anomalies within all aspects of the multispectral, particularly, I mean, in fact, it's pulled out quite well in all of them. And, I mean, obviously the one to the north there looks very encouragingly boat-shaped. So we kind of felt that actually there was still some role here in this sort of technique, but perhaps further work was required. And to some extent, you kind of, well, I mean, I haven't been back out to the site myself, but you know, one thing that we might want to do at some stage is actually just go out and corroborate what these two particular features are, because they were the strongest features within the entire two estuarine systems in terms of the fact that they were not present on the aerial photograph, but present within the multispectral imagery. Now, I just wanted to put this one in for a second here, simply because during this whole process, you're looking at these aerial photographs and these multispectral images, you're kind of navigating around and you kind of lose all sense of reality. And I think at some point I was panning across and kind of quite zoomed in, wasn't seeing the bigger picture, panning across and got to this point here, saw this kind of daisy feature in the intertidal zone, and I was like, my goodness, this is just amazing, like it's incredible, and I was just getting really excited about it. Zoomed out and then realised that it's actually associated with all these moorings. So most of these boats have got a little daisy around them where, as the tide comes in and goes out, the boat basically rotates around the central mooring, and the rope from the mooring to the boat gets caught in the mud. And it's just, that's data for you. See, that's aerial photography, that's for sure. So, so the kind of outcomes of that particular project weren't particularly strong in a, you know, we've got a great idea here perspective, but it showed enough of this kind of spark of potential that I think certainly the work that, I mean, Ollie's gone back to Denmark and he's continuing on with his kind of multispectral, hyperspectral work on certainly terrestrial, primarily farmland work, and that seems to be progressing very well, but he's still got enough of the spark that he's looking out for intertidal sites, kind of perhaps over towards Scandinavia way, to perhaps try and think more broadly, try and find a greater range, a greater number of example sites. And as I said earlier, one of the biggest problems with this was the resolution. You kind of get lulled into this full sense of security that quick bird imagery is amazingly high resolution. It's not, it's like 2.4 metres, and actually in this sort of context, 2.4 metres is quite a large cell size, you know, and a lot of the features that were present on the archaeological list were much smaller than 2.4 metres. So there's still an issue there to be dealt with in terms of the resolution of these data sets. Okay, so the third project then was something still, I suppose, continuing on with, looking at seabed morphodynamics. The project came out of a fellowship that I had with the National Maritime Museum, where I proposed I was going to look at the Suffolk coast, so kind of a small area of the Outer Thames estuary. And I kind of got down to the National Maritime Museum and started looking at these charts, and there'd be these enormous kind of A0 charts from the early 1800s covering the entire Outer Thames. And, you know, I said I was going to look at this small portion here, and yet I saw this enormous chart and I was just like, well, how can I just stop there? Like, I have to kind of think bigger, I have to do the whole area. And it was supposed to be a 3-month project, and but I'm still playing around with various aspects of it about 4 years later, really. So it was one of those things that just kind of blew out of proportion, really. But again, it was going back to kind of marine geomorphology, again, understanding system behaviour. I suppose that's what I do at the end of the day. I want to know how these things work or why they do what they do. And I was funded by the Crown Estate, which they've been absolutely brilliant. Well, I suppose they've been interested in the outcome because they own the seabed and they're obviously very interested in what's happening in terms of dredging. So their primary concern is, you know, if we're giving out all these dredging licences, is that having an impact on seabed dynamics? So this is the kind of area that we're talking about. The entire Outer Thames, I think I was working from about the Isle of Grain eastwards up to about Orford Ness and then out just east of Margate there. So quite a substantial area. And it's made up of these significant bar features. So offshore, we've got these kind of longitudinal ridges. Around the Suffolk coast, we've got some kind of hairpin bridge bar type things, still quite long and thin. And then as you move into the Thames itself, you've got these much broader sandbank features. Now, again, just a little bit of context here. One of the things about the Thames, certainly the systems of the South East in general, is that we have quite a good understanding of their kind of paleo history, their longer term evolution. So an awful lot of work has been done on the impacts of the marine transgression, reconstructing past shorelines. Those a load of work done in the 1970s, you know, trying to understand how the Thames infilled during the marine transgression, and a lot of work done on the kind of paleo history using, you know, anything from diatoms and ostracods to, you know, get a sea level curve. So the kind of bigger picture, the longer term picture, is quite well understood and quite well constrained. And then actually the very short term, small scale picture is quite well constrained as well. There's the kind of relatively recent increase in the number of wind farms out in the Outer Thames has necessitated this kind of really enhanced survey effort where a lot of people going out surveying at very, very high resolution these various features of the seabed in order to then put a load of turbines on top of them. But it means that we then have access to this sort of data, which then provides us with incredibly detailed bathymetry over some of these bridge features, where we can actually see the actual wave sand waves on the features that actually make up the ridge itself, and very clear tendencies associated with the tidal stream. So the ebbing tidal stream goes north and the flood tidal stream goes south, and we can see that the sand waves on the ridge itself are coordinated with that tidal forcing. So we've got a lot of information about how it looks at the moment, you know, very, very detailed information. But the bit in between, so anything from, you know, probably decadal through to many centuries, has just never really been looked at. Now, again, this is the Outer Thames then, so these are these main sandbanks, the offshore ridges and the Suffolk ridges up there. And one of the benefits of the Thames being where it is, as in kind of near London, is that it is a shipping area. This is just one of the examples of why this area has been mapped, surveyed over the centuries. It's because it's people coming into London and coming into various other smaller ports along the Suffolk and Essex coasts need to have navigation maps, because there's quite a hazard out there in terms of the banks and the ridges that exist. And so because of this, and the fact that people tend to run aground, we have quite a significant archive available to examine the bathymetric changes that have taken place over the centuries. Now, there's quite a range of charts available, but really, realistically, in terms of what we can do with GIS, it's only those from about the 19th century, 20th century, that are actually worthwhile doing anything with, because the ones from anything prior to the kind the early 1800s are simply too complicated in terms of their spatial kind of organisation, and there's not enough georeferencing capability within the charts themselves to actually do anything with them. So this is from 1588, this one. It has all the information on there, it has most of the banks on there, but there's just no kind of consistency in the way in which this, the coastline is presented. So it just simply can't be used at all within a GIS. So the stuff that I'm just going to run through here is looking at these 19th century charts. So the process then is quite straightforward. You take a map, you georeference it, and then about 4 weeks later you might have digitised it. So under each of these dots is a depth mark on the existing chart. And obviously once you've digitised all the depths, you have the capability of converting it to like a more regular surface, regular interval surface, raster layer, that you can then start to compare layers with layers and look at the evolution. Now, just a slight tangent at this point, just to kind of recognise one of the issues with covering such a large area, is the tide within the Outer Thames varies from essentially microtidal at the north right down to macrotidal in the Thames in the Inner Thames estuary. So up in Alderborough we've got a mean spring tide range of just over 2 metres, whereas down towards kind of Sheerness Tilbury way we're talking about a mean spring tide range of about 5 to 6 metres. And the problem that gives us is that understanding or obtaining a common datum for the entire site and a common datum that you can compare between subsequent surveys becomes an enormous problem. Most charts are referenced to either LAT, that's just astronomical tide, or mean low water springs, and that is essentially the chart datum of the chart. But that, as we've seen, varies, which means that the distance between mean sea level, or OD, and chart datum varies spatially. So across the entire Thames site, we have an enormous variation in the actual data being used for the various charts. We have a variation actually in the data that's used for the chart as well. So some charts were using LAT, some charts were using 1 foot below mean at low water springs, and so on. So there are 5 different data used across the charts that I looked at. Of course, those 5 different data also then vary spatially across the entire site. So it was a bit of a conundrum. But the only way I could really explore this and kind of put it to bed and just say, oh, you know, that's the decision I'm going to make, this is how I'm going to do it, was to simply model the datum across the entire area. So I just took the tide information at the various points across the outer Thames and I just modelled the datum surface. So this one here is just LAT with respect to OD, this one is mean low water springs with respect to OD, and therefore I had a datum surface that I could then correct each layer for and each point within the layer in order to be able to then compare against each other. The RMS on the derivation of these surfaces is around a foot, which is actually well within the kind of accuracy of a lot of the earlier surveys in terms of the depth measurements anyway. So I wasn't too worried about that kind of degree of accuracy on the actual derivation of the data surfaces. So, cut a long story short, I suppose, digitising charts, you come up with some way of dealing with the difficulties associated with datum, use that to correct all of the charts that you then produce, the surfaces that you then produce as consistent or regular surfaces across the entire site. Got 1824, 2003 there. And what's very clear from the kind of initial view of this is that you have exactly the same place, I mean exactly the same features. In 1824 and 2003, you have pretty much exactly the same kind of geomorphology, you have a series of banks here, a series of ridges here, and a series of ridges up there. And on the kind of first analysis, it looks like nothing really has changed. Now, I like my little movies, so sticking a few of these layers together and playing them through gives us a much different picture. Okay, we have exactly the same features, but they're moving around quite a lot, and we're talking about quite significant shifts, lateral shifts in these banks, and we have this like nice little wiggle of these main banks within the outer Thames as they kind of wiggle through. And then, as you can see, every now and again there's a bank here that just jumps about 20 kilometres offshore. That's because the 1824 survey, that outer Gabbard's bank, wasn't positioned correctly and was actually positioned too far inshore. So we've got quite clear evidence of where there are problems in the data, but we've also got evidence of the degree to which these banks are actually dynamic and the way in which they're actually moving over over this kind of decadal sort of timescale. Now, these few plots here, then I've just chopped off the outer banks because they cause a lot of problems. And we've just got a mean, a standard deviation also gives us the degree of variability in depth over time. And then I applied a linear regression. And most of these analyses actually did within MATLAB because it's actually a lot easier to deal with these sorts of data sets within MATLAB, well, I find it easier. And I actually then only use things like ArcGIS to present the data later on. But it was the linear regression that was quite useful because I had quite a number, certainly for the inner section, I had about, I think, 10 layers in total between 1824 and 2003, which enabled me to actually do a linear regression over time for every single cell within the raster layer, which then gave me some representation of trend within the seabed changes. So what we've got here are where the blue is where there's a significant positive trend, and where the red is where there's a significant negative trend. So basically progressive accretion or build-up versus progressive erosion and breakdown. One other thing I did with this, again, this is where like the broader capabilities of a GIS really come into play. You have all these skills in kind of normal maths and normal statistics, but to be able to actually do it on spatial data as well is really quite something useful. So again, I used all of these layers to then run PCA on the changes in the bed morphology over the various time scales. Zone 1, I just used the latter periods because of this issue with the early surveys and positioning. And from this, we're able to derive kind of the principal components, you know, the strongest gradients within the data itself. PC1 here. On the whole, what this seems to show is the main lateral movements within the banks. So in all of these, the kind of the strongest differences within the PC maps actually show are either side of a bank. So where a bank has basically moved from one position to another, and you have like strong erosion on one side, a strong accretion on the other, and that's what the first component generally pulls out. Now an example, this is Kentish Knot here, where we've basically got a feature that has moved quite substantially over the time frame considered. 3D view of this shows that it started out as a relatively kind of oval feature, then that started to kind of elongate and kind of move over time into a rather crescentic sort of feature that kind of links down to another bank at the southern end there. So this is something that has very much eroded on its western side, very much accreted on its southern and eastern side. And then you can corroborate this with Transex view the actual feature itself, which show how, you know, over time it's kind of grown in one direction, so it's lengthened, and then also it's migrated in another direction. Now the second component is it's slightly less straightforward, and certainly when you're looking at the PC map, doesn't really show you anything that you can pull out directly from the map itself. But when you look at the actual eigenvalues, or eigenvectors rather, of the components, this is zone 2 here, and this particular eigenvector here shows something that basically goes through almost an entire cycle of change. So it's relatively high, goes through a period in the 1900s of being relatively low, and then goes relatively high again. So we've got an expression of change there that's gone essentially through a cycle. Now that feature there is Shingles Patch and Edinburgh Channels. And if we look at that one in particular, on a change map, so this is South Edinburgh Channel and North Edinburgh Channel, and we have a feature in the middle called Shingles Patch, which, so over the 180-year time cycle, Edinburgh and North and South Edinburgh Channels have kind of really cut in, but then this enormous patch bank feature in the middle has grown up. So on all of these subsequent maps, the outline of the current configuration is provided in the line, and the underlying raster is the year associated with the date up there. So back in 1824, we actually had two quite strong channels and quite a large feature. But then subsequently, that large feature basically decayed away, and actually around, I think, 1910, there was almost nothing here, and we had just one channel through here. And then since the early 1900s, Northern Edinburgh channels have basically cut through and allowed the development of this big patch in the middle. So this little embryo feature here has just built up and then allowed the entrenchment of the two Edinburgh channels around it. So actually we have gone through an entire cycle, because we've gone from having a relatively large bank surrounded by two channels to almost no bank with one major channel, to then a relatively large bank with two channels around it. So it's quite a nice way of, or kind of a representation of that sort of scale of change or cycle of change over that period. So what do we get from all of this then? Well, I suppose the broader project was showing, was allowing us to, kind of understand the degree to which the features that seem to be present for so many centuries were actually dynamic in their kind of local scale. The fact that we have quite significantly different trends of change or behaviours associated with the change that was observed. So we had progressive movement, we had significant kind of migration in one direction, erosion on one side versus accretion on another. But we also had kind of cyclical movement where things kind of built up and broke down, or broke down and then built up again. So over the same time scale, we've got a number of different behaviours present. And to some extent, the behaviours are associated with these kind of main different features. So the offshore ridges are relatively stable. They tend to be dominated by tides. The headland associated banks up near Suffolk were shifting around a little bit, and they tend to be primarily associated with tides, but with a bit of wave action on them. But then the banks within the central estuary, which were moving significantly, certainly in terms of lateral shifts, plus the modifications of these smaller bank features we've got on the entire longer banks, and you have these kind of cross-channel banks cutting through that seem to operate over almost decadal timescales. That's much more driven by waves, with the added kind of help of tides in terms of moving sediment along the actual banks themselves. So I guess, again, GIS has been instrumental within the kind of recognition of these trends and recognition of these behaviours, and really, you know, that sort of job, that sort of project couldn't be done without, you know, the assistance of the capabilities of GIS. So I just wanted to end on this one last slide, which basically undermines everything that I've talked about, because problem with all of this historical stuff that I do is that you're depending on what was done at the time. You know, what was measured in 1823 or what was surveyed in 1864. I am relying on the fact that, one, they did the job correctly, and two, that it was a representation of reality at that particular point in time. And a few years ago, I went down to the UK Hydrographic Office archives, and I was looking at some charts of my estuaries in Ireland, and they'd given me the published chart from the 1860s for my two estuaries, and it was very detailed, very nice, I was super excited, happy to go away, and then the woman came back and she said, oh, I've just found this, is this of interest? And it was the actual plan sheet of the survey where the information had been written onto the actual chart, onto the sheet itself, so most of the depths were still in there, transects, the lines, there hadn't been any kind of modification or simplification of the data. And then there was these scribbles around this estuary map, so this is all kind of in red, and what was on the published version is the channel being along here, very, very clear channel, and a lot of sediment either side of it. And what we've got on the top there, if you can read it, is, it says the red dotted line shows the state of the bar in August 1859. Change stated to have occurred during the preceding winter, in which there was a succession of heavy westerly gales. That information never made it to the chart that was published. And in actual fact, all the charts that were published in the 1800s, and all the maps that were published in the 1800s, had the channel in this southerly position, which made you assume that it was incredibly stable, it was always in that position, and so the information that I had from perhaps the 1970s and 80s, where the channel was suddenly in a northerly position, seemed completely out of character, because gosh, throughout the 19th century, it had always been in the southerly position. And in actual fact, it had occurred in the northern position in the 1850s as well, it's just it never made it through to the published version, which then kind of makes the whole thing why have we got that respect? It's fun anyway, so anyway, I'll stop there.
Site actually is what defines an archaeological
Yeah, exactly. many pixels and therefore was able to give you a signature. And that's why, you know, those couple of features I showed that weren't visible on the aerial photograph but were visible in the multispectral were relatively large in size. I mean, you know, I like to keep saying, I think they're a boat, but I think they are a boat because they're that sort of size. And having something that sort of scale means that you're much more likely to pick it up through the imagery. But until we have an imagery that is down to kind of tens of centimetres in resolution, the multispectral, hyperspectral, we haven't got hope of getting any of the detail. So there's always going to be a need for archaeologists going out, certainly in the near future. It just depends which kind of gets, which progresses quicker, I suppose.
Well, can you just ask what you just said there, but what English, who was that getting the funding that
English Heritage?
What was their reaction then to your sort of findings? Were they kind of concerned about the numerology of how we've got 420 scheduled sites that whenever you will be found 10%, or were they kind of going, right, all the ones you could find, you know, that are more than 2.4 metres big or whatever, you found all of them fantastic, wasn't it?
Yeah, no, I mean, I have to say they were a bit like the Danish, they kind of lost interest when it became clear that this wasn't going to be like the next thing slits to spread, you know. But, I mean, they were very supportive in a usual way, I suppose.
There's one from Bruce now.
Was this a very interesting talk, thank you. I'm just interested how you move this methodology into the future now that organisations such as the Hydrographic Office, rather than having distinct publications of paper charts, they're now effectively continuously publishing.
Yeah.
Data continues to change.
Certainly in terms of coastal seabed sort of sites, it's not actually about the UKHO anymore. There are so many independent studies being done on a large portion of our kind of shelf and coastal seas that what actually makes it through to the UKHO is actually going to be useful for the person in the boat driving around. That's going to be pretty much it. For the person actually doing the science, you're not actually interested in that anymore because you know that, C-SCAN or somebody's been out there with a seismic sonar or something that has got multi-beam data, and you know the capability of the technology now is just absolutely amazing. It's just the, you know, obviously from now on in, any certainly at the smaller scale, looking at changes in the edges of these banks, the movement of sand waves, that can all be readily understood within a few years of successive high resolution surveys, and completely unrelated to what UKHO are doing. But it's just going back is the problem, you know, actually taking information from the past and looking at the slightly longer term. Until we've got a few more decades under our belts, we've got little to guide us in terms of the longer term development of these sorts of features and the long term forcing.
But there's no concern in terms of the sort of current and future data, because there's a huge diversity of surveys being done by a whole range of different people. These are curated and kept and maintained so that people can do longer term studies.
Well, yeah, there is that. That's for sure. One of the biggest problems is access to data. You know, because most of this data isn't actually free anymore. I don't know how that's going to.
Well, there's the Crown State Round 3 process. You have to submit a lot of your survey data to the Crown State. Because I've actually worked on quite a lot of the posts for Round 3 wind farm. So a huge amount of seabed. Obviously a great expense.
Yeah,
I don't know where that will come available or not.
No.
Is that the civil hydrography stuff is free?
Sorry?
The civil hydrography project surveys are free.
Are they?
They should be.
Oh, you mean the UKHO stuff? That's not free.
No?
No.
No, Marine Scotland, that's civil hydrography.
Oh, okay.
It doesn't come into the coast in most cases.
We're removing aggregate sustainability levy fund as well. Huge amounts of data for the Thames Estuary numbers.
Yeah, it's not free.
Is it not?
No.
Yeah, sure.
Because, well, no, as far as I'm aware, it's not free. If you're coming into it completely unguided, you would get paid for it. And the only way that you'd get it for free is if you came in through
Historic Scotland. I work for Wessex Archaeology. We've done a study on the availability of this kind of data and the constraints that apply to it, not just multi-beam and side scan, but multi-spectral. So, it would be interesting.
Freely available on?
Yeah, that's available through our website.
Okay.
I was going to say, we've got archaeologists amongst our MSc students this year. Yeah,
it's quite a huge conversation in archaeology. I was wondering, has there actually been any follow-up excavation of any features you've discovered?
No. And that's what I was getting at, that English heritage seemed to lose interest.
Right.
So even though in my final report, I tried to dig up these things that we did find that weren't explained,
maps as a basis for maybe creating some kind of plan or horizontal stratigraphy of the use of the coastline or anything.
Well, that was the idea, but because we had so many problems in the literature in terms of actually dealing with the multispectral data and actually getting it to tell us anything, that the whole kind of reconstruction of prehistories we just didn't really look at. I mean, in actual fact, if we had put really any effort into it, it would have been difficult for that particular site because most of the archaeology is so scattered and it's not structural. There's very, very little that's actually kind of representing use and activity at the shoreline or in a particular environment. So actually, I don't think it would lend itself to a very good evaluation of use.
So it's all very early prehistory kind of slightly refined, is it?
Yeah, I mean, it's just, yeah, most of the stuff that is there is very disparate and not really representing activity at a particular time or habitation at a particular time. I mean, there are a few things, but they're just so, there's just not enough consistency, I suppose, in the data and in the archaeology.
Just let Stuart in there and come back this side.
You've got this time series of ethnography from the tail of history. Is there any effort to try stepping forward and look at what's going to happen in the future?
I did play around with that. I was messing around in MATLAB looking at ways of just taking, say, even the linear regression like 10 years forward. I'm not a big fan of predicting, so whenever I look at anything that you derive through those sorts of predictions, I'm incredibly critical of it, and I just would not. I was just not comfortable doing that. It gives you a lovely picture, and it potentially says so much, and that is really problematic if you then put it in a report to the Crown Estate, because they don't necessarily have the critical mindset to understand that that's not potentially the reality that will occur.
I was just wondering why it was more effective to use multispectral in Denmark than it turned out to be to use it in the UK. Was that the geology or the data that you used?
I think it was a combination of, it was terrestrial for a start, all the work that they've done is terrestrial, so you haven't got any issues with modifications in the intertidal zone. I mean, I think Ole was convinced that it was because sediment had been removed and, that the signatures had been removed. I don't think it was that as such. I think it was simply the fact that the features that were present had been scattered so much that they no longer presented a strong signature within the sediments. The stuff that they've done in Scandinavia, obviously on land, and it's primarily in fields. So what you have there are archaeologies that have basically been covered by arable land. So you then have very significant large areas of one crop type that, from a multispectral perspective, anything that's going to affect the crops in one particular area, certainly in terms of moisture availability, is going to be very visible within a multispectral image.
So in the intertidal zone, you just had no vegetation.
Exactly. Yeah. So the reliance was on the fact that the modifications to the sediment associated with the presence of an under a subsurface feature just wasn't strong enough for it to have any impact on. There is vegetation there, but it's obviously a different type of vegetation. But it's the fact that, you know, it's all waterlogged. You know, at low tide, everything's still waterlogged. And so it has to be quite a large feature for it to have any real significant surface expression from subsurface sediments.
So any scope to turn that on its head and then look for organic sediments like peats that are submerged or just shallowly buried on the coast for submerged prehistoric landscapes, things like that?
Again, some of the archaeological features that were registered were peat layers. So those kind of paleo features were present in the registered list and were not visible within the multispectral. But I mean, so the work that Ole's been doing, I mean, he's actually gone out and done geochemical analysis on the sediments associated with these features, and he seems to think that multispectral is able to pick out quite an enhanced geochemistry, and that's why he was convinced it was going to work within the intertidal zone, because it wasn't reliant on the moisture. Now my perspective is I think really it's just it's moisture that the multispectral is going to pick up, and I think they're just very lucky that in the Scandinavian sites that they've got other geochemistry that just seems to all add together in the same way that the moisture aspect does.
Well, final question from Angus.
So the question is more just a sort of observation stroke factoid, interesting enough. I remember a poem about this historical aspect of the Hydrographic Office of Archive. The seminar, big GIS seminar, and I got lots of years ago, and then a tour of the building and the archives and stuff. And I remember the librarian or the chief archivist saying actually they had a map from Captain Cook survey, and it was done on goat skin. And that had proved to be more stable as a medium for recording data than all some subsequent stuff on, you know, this from my kind of old CAD days or whatever you could spend, you know. £100 a roll for this stuff that would be, you know, the skull would be supposedly moisture stable over 20 years or whatever. So actually the most unstable thing in the archive was like 300 years ago written in a goat skin.
Interesting.
If you ever got to see the match, having to take measurements from the actual chart, because that'd be great, somebody or whatever, and then calculate and then go for goat skin every time.
And it has all the useful information that the editors choose to remove. I think we'll draw questions to a close. There should be some refreshment still at the back. And following that, Bruce is rather keen that I remind you all that we usually move to the TV at Library Bar. Excellent opportunity for networking and socialising and maybe further discussion. So the TV at Library Bar. And just before I say thank you, there's actually a vicious rumour that I planned some of these talks around my holidays, and it's totally can't be true. I haven't done the Essex Coast yet, but there is a rather nice book out at the moment, self-published, I think it's Local Knowledge. So it's on my list, but I don't know if the on-land, on-shore stuff will be as interesting as the intertidal and offshore, but it's certainly fascinating landforms. So I'd just like to say thanks once again to Helen for a very interesting talk.